You're listening to The Leonard Lopate Show on AM 820 and 93.9 WNYC.
The New Yorker is celebrating its 90th birthday, and to mark the occasion, they've published a special double issue looking at their history decade by decade. The years between 1965 and 1975 are described by The New Yorker's fiction editor, Deborah Treisman, as a time when many of the writers that have come to be seen as the canon of New Yorker fiction, John Cheever, John Updike, Muriel Spark, Mavis Gallant, Donald Barthelme, and Beatty, published some of their most significant work in the magazine. I am delighted to welcome Deborah Treisman back to our show today. Hello.
Hi, thanks for having me.
This current issue has a story by Haruki Murakami, and recently you've run work by Toni Morrison, Dave Eggers, Karen Russell, Colm Tóibín, Jhumpa Lahiri, Roddy Doyle, Jonathan Lethem, Zadie Smith, Louise Erdrich. Mm-hmm. Something of a who's who of contemporary literature. Do they all send in their stories to you?
Yeah. I mean, some people send in directly, some people through agents and so on. But most of the ones you mentioned, we have ongoing relationships with.
When The New Yorker began publishing in 1925, was the short fiction program anywhere as ambitious as it is today?
No. Initially, it was the magazine as a whole was nowhere near as ambitious. It was more of a humor magazine and a localized thing. And its ambitions really expanded and grew over time. I think the first fiction editor of the magazine, Catherine White, started in the 30s, and I think under her sort of aegis, the ambitions for fiction in the magazine really expanded.
Because when I think of the early fiction, some pretty good people, mm-hmm. but Thurber,
yeah.
Robert Benchley,
yeah.
you had pieces by Groucho Marx, Ogden Nash, and of course, Dorothy Parker.
Right, right. Yeah, I mean, but at the time, that was considered more humor writing than fiction. You know, there wasn't the same kind of mandate to be literary.
And then William Maxwell became fiction mm-hmm. editor in 1936.
Mm-hmm.
I suspect that was a major change.
Mm-hmm.
So what kind of fiction did he tend to choose?
Well, 1935 is when you see the first John Cheever story in the magazine. And there was an expansion of short story writing and fiction in the country as a whole. You know, in those days, there were often two pieces of fiction in an issue. Sometimes there were three, and they were kind of classified differently than they are now. We have our one piece a week, and somehow everything is weighing on that piece, so you take it quite seriously. In the old days, there was the A fiction and the B fiction, and one of these pieces was meant to be sort of serious fiction, and one was meant to be something lighter and more comical or casual.
Well, you often have a one-page comic.
We have Shouts and Murmurs, which is categorized as humor writing rather than as fiction writing.
Maxwell was a great short story writer on his own.
Mm-hmm.
Did that affect the way he looked at other people's writing?
Well, you know, I wish I'd known Maxwell.
He was on the show once.
Was he?
Yeah, many years ago.
Yeah, I wish I had
one
known him.
One of my great thrills.
I mean, he's someone, if you read any of his correspondence with writers from the time, it's just miraculously sensitive. So I'm sure, you know, in my mind, I think it's better not to be a fiction writer if you're a fiction editor, because you don't want to be competing with you know, the people you're editing in a way, and you don't want to be sort of have a fixed mindset about a certain goal for fiction. But somehow he pulled it off.
And he also had the opportunity to publish himself. Decade from 1965 to 75 was an era of change in this country, the civil mm-hmm. rights movement, mm-hmm. gay rights, anti-war, women's movements, all in full swing, and the counterculture influence music, film, and art. How did they affect the fiction that The New Yorker was running?
Well, I just think there was kind of an enormous expansion of voices in the magazine, and so you have these people who've been publishing for some time, like Updike and Cheever, at the same time, you get someone new, like Donald Barthelme, who started publishing in the magazine in 1963, and whose writing was radically different, you know, I mean, to some people, incomprehensible and unimaginable in the magazine. But it took fiction in a different direction. There was a certain anarchy to what he was doing, and I think this encouraged expansion in other directions. You know, this is 1967 is when you first see stories by Borges appearing in The New Yorker, and you see an opening.
Was that
up.
The beginning of stories in translation?
Well, there had been stories in translation for quite a while. Nabokov had been in the magazine for, you know,
although
quite
he
some
did
time.
Write very good English.
But I believe there had been a period of time when translation was frowned on, and then suddenly it wasn't anymore.
Although there was also a certain staid quality to the fiction that was published when Sean was the editor. That changed when Tina Brown came in, and suddenly we started seeing words that were not allowed during the Sean period. How important is the editor-in-chief rather than the fiction editor in determining the tone of the fiction that's being published?
Well, very important in determining the tone of the whole magazine. And I think the different editors-in-chief have had different or varying degrees of interest in the fiction. You know, the Sean years may have been stayed in terms of using swear words in stories, but less stayed in terms of actual stylistic craziness.
And we when I look at the list of people who have published in The New Yorker, well, one of the first names that comes to mind is Alice Munro, won a Nobel not so long ago.
Right.
But I.B. Singer, you mentioned Nabokov, Jhumpa Lahiri, Borges, and now more recently Haruki Murakami, Junot Diaz, Dinah Mengistu, Orhan Pamuk, Roberto Bolaño, even though he's dead, we get an awful lot of writing by him, Chimamanda Ngozi Adichie. This kind of now suggests that you're doing world literature.
Well, you know, the world of fiction is the world of world literature. There's
no longer just the stories about people living in the suburbs north of New York.
Right. I mean, that was always a sort of apocryphal vision of fiction in The New Yorker. I mean, if you look back at the years when that was supposedly what the magazine was publishing, you'll find at least as many stories about radically different things. But there has been a major influx in the U.S. of writers from other places, who are writing in English or sometimes in translation. And there's just, I think, been an expansion of how we think about fiction.
My guest is Deborah Treisman, who is the current editor of fiction at The New Yorker. You followed Bill Buford, and you've been there how long now, about a dozen years?
I've been in this job for about a dozen, and I was deputy under Bill for 5 years, yeah.
When you took on the job, did you feel you had a mandate to put in the kind of writers you felt strongly about?
I suppose so. I mean, I felt I had a mandate really just to publish the best stories that were out there and that were being written.
Of course, your idea of what the best story isn't necessarily the next person's best
story. It might be different, yeah. But, you know, there's a fiction department and everything is sort of battered around and discussed among a group.
Didn't Bill Buford leave to pursue his own writing career?
Yes, he
did. Can you imagine doing that for yourself sometime?
No, you know, this is why I think it's very good not to have those ambitions.
How much is an important name in determining whether a story is getting published? We don't see too many unknowns. I'm sure some of them are writing wonderful fiction.
You do see unknowns. It's just that as soon as they're in The New Yorker, they're known. I think on average, you know, a third to a quarter of the stories we publish every year are by people who haven't been in the magazine before.
Hmm.
So these names pop up. You know, you would see Junot Diaz, but he wasn't known at the time when he was first published. Now he's considered establishment in a way. So I think the New Yorker is important in creating the reputation of establishment, but they don't always start that way.
I probably shouldn't say this, but I mentioned to somebody that there was an Alice Munro story in another magazine, and the person said, well, The New Yorker probably passed on it. That's how it wound up there.
Mm-hmm. It's true that even the biggest names get rejected.
Really?
Mm-hmm.
Do you read other literary magazines? That has to be a lot easier today than it was 15 or 20 years ago. There are so few these days.
Well, there are fewer, you know, sort of behemoth magazines that publish fiction, but there are just as many, if not more, smaller publications.
You're publishing something like 50 stories a year,
mm-hmm.
which seems like a lot, but it's also very little when you consider the pool that you're drawing from.
Yeah, I mean, we find it a challenge to find 50 stories we think are great every year. I mean, it is. There are only so many wonderful works of short fiction out there that are being written.
How many submissions do you receive in a typical week?
Hundreds.
Mm. And you said mostly from agents, although I suspect you have.
They come in all.
Is there
ways.
A slush fund as well?
I wish there were a slush fund.
Slush pile.
There is a virtual slush pile, which is less intimidating than the physical slush pile used to be. And things come in directly from writers. They're referred by other writers. They're coming through agents, publishers, any way they can.
I'm assuming you don't read all the stories yourself from the start. So there's somebody else out there who's passing one on to you saying,
right.
Deborah,
this
is a pretty good story.
There are two other people who edit fiction, Cressida Leishen and Willing Davidson. And, you know, Roger Angel, who is the son of Catherine White, who is the first fiction editor, is still at the magazine and has been weighing in on fiction for a long time now.
What happens, we've heard this about this during discussions of the cartoons, what happens if you like a story but David Remnick, the editor-in-chief, doesn't? Does he get the final say?
He does, yeah. He's the editor-in-chief. But it doesn't happen too often that something gets vetoed in that way.
Once a piece is accepted, how do you work with the writer? You don't do fact checks.
Oh, yeah, of course. Of course. Fiction is all fact checked.
I thought the whole idea of fiction is that it doesn't involve facts.
Yeah. Well, it does involve facts. That's sort of the paradox of fiction, is that if you get your facts wrong, then your fiction is less likely to be credible.
There are rumors that New Yorker editors have been in the habit of cutting the last paragraph of a story.
That's interesting. I did actually just send out a proof this week to a writer suggesting cutting his last paragraph, but it's not an automatic reflex. Sometimes you cut the first paragraph. Sometimes it's just throat clearing. And sometimes people go past the point at which they should have stopped.
And I'm sure that there are sentences in the middle that you feel
of course.
Just not working. What needs to be fact-checked in a work of fiction?
In fiction. Well, for instance, if somebody describes a meeting that happened at a train station in Calcutta, and in fact they're describing a train station in Mumbai, we would want to correct that, because it's anything that sounds wrong is going to pull the reader out of the story.
On the other hand, I remember speaking to a Martin Amis about where he sets things. He said, you know, I really don't go to Camden Town. This was when he was still living in Britain. Mm-hmm. And check to see if the fish and chip shop is next to the bank. It doesn't really matter.
Right. Well, then our fact checker would go and check and tell him he has to change it.
How has the proliferation of MFA writing programs affected your job? Do you get a lot of submissions from MFA students?
Yeah, we do. I mean, it's created an interesting sort of two-tiered system in the U.S., which is that the publishing industry puts a huge amount of pressure on writers to write novels. And the MFA programs are really set up for people to write short stories. So you have a lot of short fiction writers emerging from MFA programs and then having to switch to novels. I'm grateful for the programs for keeping the form alive.
Now, I'm assuming you also do read novels, even though you don't
of
publish
course,
them.
Yeah. And occasionally we do excerpts from them.
And would you decide, you know, chapter 3 would be really great, let's talk to the publisher or the agent?
Yeah, that happens, or talk to the writer herself or himself, yeah.
What do you read in your spare time?
What spare time?
Well, I'm so glad you took a couple of moments off to come by and visit us. Deborah Chaseman here to talk about the fiction in The New Yorker, which is celebrating its 90th birthday. That's extraordinary.
That's fantastic, yeah.
And for many people, the last great source of serious fiction in a major magazine. There used to be so many.
Yeah, yeah. Well, it's a wonderful thing to be in charge of keeping that alive.
Thank you again for being on our show.
Thanks so much.